Dear Call Me By Your Name. Thanks for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded ancestral and traditional lands of the Hankamunim-speaking Musqueam people here on UBC Vancouver campus. My name is Dora, and in December of 2017, I saw Call Me By Your Name, Luca Guadagnino's groundbreaking film, almost by accident. It was a Christmas present for my mom. She likes to see kind of Oscar bait movies, and I thought it would be nice to take her to this one because she seemed interested. I hadn't ever heard of it. I had watched one episode of it in a video on YouTube a few months before, but had never watched the trailer. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know who made it, but after watching it a few minutes in, I was completely entranced. If you haven't seen this movie, it is definitely one of my favorite movies that I've ever seen. I'm not sure why it struck me so much. We're going to be exploring that in this next hour in a love letter to Call Me By Your Name. It's kind of an open letter, if you will. But in this time, I'm going to go over a few things. The first thing I'm going to start out with is I'm going to talk about some of the themes and like basic imagery that I found really striking, and I'll have some examples from the film. Anytime that there are visuals, I'm going to try to describe them, although I highly encourage you to watch it. And then I'm going to go into some of my favorite scenes, and going to end kind of addressing the issues that there are with this movie. No love is perfect. You have to accept things for their limitations, things and people. So the first step in doing that is acknowledging it and working through it. So that's this hour. That's what you've signed up for. For Pride programming, our special day of Pride programming. For those of you who don't know or haven't seen Call Me By Your Name by Luca Guadagnino, it's a story that follows a 17-year-old boy whose father is a classics professor, and they are vacationing at his mother's family house in northern Italy, and it's 1983. The child's name is Elio Perlman, and while they're on vacation, his father, it's revealed to us annually, will bring in a graduate student to help him with his work. And this year, the student is Oliver. Oliver is 24 years old. He is played by Armie Hammer in this movie. Timothée Chalamet plays Elio Perlman. And these two young men, kind of suss each other out, fall in love, or whatever type of affection you can really form in 6 weeks, and then part at the end of the movie. The film is based off of the book Call Me By Your Name by Andre Isiman. He identifies as heterosexual, and I think that this is really, really important in acknowledging right off the bat that this story was written in an essentially fantasized way. So comparing the book and the movie, I haven't finished the book yet, but comparing the two mediums and kind of vessels for this story and the emotions and experiences within it. The book is, I almost want to describe it as almost pulp-y. I don't, no offense to this book, I have a lot of respect for it and I have a lot of admiration towards it, just even considering that it acknowledged and produced this narrative that I found really touching. But I wouldn't argue that it's necessarily well written, and it is a really, like, it's a very visible platform for the problems that arise when discussing the movie, kind of like the age gap between the two men and the classism and kind of elitism that's inherently embedded in it. So comparing them, it's a little bizarre, but also the book goes on beyond the point that the film ends. And I also think that this is a really important thing to note because, it almost speaks to the genius of Guadagnino because the film doesn't feel unfinished. It doesn't feel like you ended the story, like cut it off in the middle of of the narrative, which I guess you could argue that that is what he did. But it does really complement, I think, what Guadagnino was trying to do. So Call Me By Your Name is part three of a trilogy that Guadagnino worked on, the Desire trilogy. This trilogy includes I Am Love, which came out in 2009, and A Bigger Splash, which came out in 2015. Both of those movies actually feature Tilda Swinton. And this kind of a side note for listeners who want a love letter as well as some fun facts. Timothée Chalamet, who plays the main character in Call Me By Your Name, actually got the role because his agent represents Tilda Swinton and had a relationship with Guadagnino already. And Guadagnino actually doesn't audition any of his actors. He just hires them. Hope he meets them, and I think that this is reflected also in his style of film, but I think that his casting is mainly done through their appearance and also through their previous body of work. So he's not looking to see if the actor understands the character. He's not really interested in seeing a character be manipulated and kind of bitten at many times by people who are trying to impress him. It's a kind of a weird, I'm sure it must be a weird kind of facade experience. But he's looking for actors who he's confident can take the characters that he believes in and the visions that he has for them and physically embody that character on the screen. And I think part of what made this movie so successful, because it was, Call Me By Your Name was very successful, it was nominated for an Oscar and Chalamet was nominated for Best Actor, is that Guadagnino almost lucked out with Chalamet's actually tremendous acting talent. I have a lot of thoughts on Chalamet, that's almost a whole other episode. But I don't think that anyone could really deny that he is really glorious in this film and understands the character very well. And Guadagnino, as a director, was really able to kind of flex his muscles just in that this film was really a masterpiece in his filmography. And it's not something that people are going to be forgetting anytime soon. And part of why I think that that is he understands film, or his understanding of film is very active. There's no part in the movie that doesn't communicate the type of kind of tenderness and playfulness that he's trying to come across. So what I'm really thinking of to just like that brings us out in my mind is his use of the credits. The opening credits I thought were really, really gorgeous. That was obviously the first thing that I saw and I was immediately attracted and hooked on it. And there's very playful music in the background, quite bright colors, and it's just scatterings of, it almost looks like the house, like little tableaus of things that are happening in the home with that are connected to the actor or the role of the person who is being credited on the screen. So all of the actors, he kind of uses images or combinations of images of ancient classical sculptors, which it becomes clear ancient sculpture is Elio's father's area of focus in antiquity and antiquity studies, classical studies. But each statue is chosen very deliberately, positioned very deliberately. Every tableau of a typewriter or a bank statement or a set of cards is deliberately used, and it's never, it never feels ornamental, it just feels expressive. And I think that he has a really beautiful eye for using the smallest amount of things. His film is, no scene ever seems full. Everything just seems kind of like very well spaced and very well articulated and concise, but without losing any of the kind of raw beauty, especially in any of nature shots of his. In this film specifically, and the credits just set up the entire film and what we're about, what the audience and the viewer and the spectator is about to experience absolutely beautifully. And then the end credits is probably the most discussed sequence in the film. It's just a shot of Elio kind of sitting in front of a fire, listening to the song Visions of Gideon, which was written for the film, and crying and processing as there's kind of movement behind him, and this credits the all kind of roll next to him. But it's just Chalamet on screen. And that also really perfectly concludes exactly what the viewer has just experienced. And that emotional kind of active catharsis almost is just perfectly expressed. So just to give you an idea of that scene, I'm going to play that song now, Visions of Gideon. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded ancestral and traditional land of the Hencomenem-speaking Musqueam people. The BC government now covers medications that could reduce your chances of contracting HIV by 90%. PREP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis and is a preventative measure that HIV-negative folks can take to reduce their risk of becoming positive. Health Initiative for Men suggests that if you have had sex with a partner with HIV, have had a recent STI, have multiple sexual partners, have a history of inconsistent or no condom use, are currently involved in sex work, or have had repeated courses of post-exposure prophylaxis, then you might want to think about looking into PREP measures. CATR and Discorder are not medical professionals. Please refer to your doctor for more information.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Is it a video? Is it a video? I have touched you for the last time. Is it a video? Is it a video?
Is this your orchard?
These are anellos trees.
Oh, wow.
Pesca, ciliegie, albicoque.
Pomegranate. Melograno. Have another egg.
Oh, that's cute. No. I know myself too well. If I have a second, I'm just going to have a third and then a fourth, and then you're just going to have to roll me out of here. Delicious.
Darling?
Thank you.
I give him Anquises, Vike.
You're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded ancestral and traditional land of the Hencomenem-speaking Musqueam people on UBC Vancouver campus. My name is Dora, and today CITR is hosting 12 hours of Pride programming, and you're listening to A Love Letter to Call Me By Your Name. You just heard Visions of Gideon, a song written for the film when it came out. and a scene from the film, or a short clip from the film, that really quickly, or I think very well, encapsulates two of the things that I really wanted to talk about today: bikes and fruit. So, for those of you who don't know, Call Me By Your Name is set in northern Italy, and Elio, the main character's father, is a classics professor. In ancient Greek and Roman literature, fruit is a very common manifestation of desire, sexuality, sensuality, but also distraction. Fruit is a really important and consistent part of Call Me By Your Name. So the clip that you heard just a few minutes ago is when Oliver has just arrived and he's kind of woken up on his first day, and he comes down to breakfast and he's asking about the space and what kind of amenities are available to him. And they're in this beautiful orchard that Elio's mother inherited and cares for. And they kind of list all of the fruit that is yielded by this orchard. They're cherries, apricots, peaches, pomegranates. And Oliver, the character, is kind of, as they're discussing this, gets kind of swept up in eating this egg and is very, like, ravenous in it. And then Elio and Oliver go for a bike ride to an urban space. And pretty much all of the details in this sequence are really relevant for the rest of the film. So fruit as this kind of like sexual almost catalyst, and then bicycles as an activity and something joining the two men together, but then also the leaving the kind of idyllic, pocketed, isolated, more rural area of the home and going to this urban space. The bicycles is one of my favorite vessels of imagery, I guess, in this film, because it's a like transportation machine that allows someone kind of like freedom, but it's not so intense or so weighted as a car or any other kind of like motorcycle, tractor, whatever. It's quite nimble and very flexible as a transportation device. Bikes have two main functions in this film. The first one being an agent of transportation and ease. And the second one as a metaphor for expressing homosexuality. So almost like kind of like getting back on a bicycle. It's as easy as riding a bike. In this scene, Elio is offering to lead and tour Oliver to this urban space, and he's also volunteering Ankiza's bike. Ankiza is this old handyman who lives with them, and he is kind of like their gay fairy godmother. And I love there's a moment as they're getting ready where Oliver is kind of dusting off Ankiza's bike. He's checking to make sure that it's still working, but also getting it back into like function. And then Elio is right next to him inspecting his bike, which is new and pristine, but again, making sure that it functions, but for the opposite reason. While Oliver is kind of bringing something in disuse and revitalizing it, Elio is making sure that something unused is able to be used and is ready to be used. To me, this is a really obvious, almost metaphor for the experience of homosexuality and the practice of it. And the two of them go biking a lot throughout the film, and they bike through urban spaces, through rural spaces, through farms, through woodlands, down cobbled streets. And as they continue to grow their affection for each other and continue to explore the possibility of a sexual relationship, they do so mainly on bike excursions. The bikes as metaphor for the practice of homosexuality, but also for the expression of their relationship, if that makes sense. So there are a lot of, I'm thinking of a moment where they're about to get in the car to go to visit a dredging site where Elio's father's colleagues have found a beautiful statue. And this woman who Oliver has been kind of flirting with comes and visits on a bike, and she has a brief interaction with Elio, and then she goes into the house and comes out with Oliver, and he continues his kind of subtle pursuit. And then she bikes away, and Elio and Oliver are left standing at the car uncomfortably and have this like tense moment.
Tu étais incroyable hier soir, sur la piste.
Ouais, il danse bien.
Il danse bien. Il est beau aussi, hein?
Tu veux nous brancher ou quoi?
Non. Allez, rentre. Dad always sits up front with Anquisa to navigate. She seems to like you a lot. She's more beautiful than she was last year. I saw her naked on a night swim once. Great body.
Trying to get me to like her?
What would be the harm in that?
Well, no harm. I just typically like to go those things on my own, if you don't mind.
Guida, we award you. Non ti preoccupare.
Just don't play at being a good host.
What's going on, boys? Oliver, come. Sit up front. Be my navigator.
What? What?
And then later, once they've consummated their relationship a little bit more, then the same woman comes and visits, and Oliver bikes away almost immediately.
Oh, hey, are you leaving? Where's Elio?
He's inside. He had a bit of a nosebleed during lunch, so he's just resting.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be back in a minute.
But
don't go anywhere.
So the use of the bicycle is kind of the entering of a potentially romantic or like sensual space in a relationship. And then the car as this larger machine that Elio and Oliver are getting into and performing in. And then coming back to the freedom of the bicycle and using it to exit this heterosexual performance, I just find very exciting. So that's a lot about bikes. The other thing that I wanted to mention or that I wanted to focus on that came up from the original sequence of them at the breakfast table was fruits. So Again, I kind of the same way that I don't think it's an accident that the bike happened to be Anquiza's, who is this observer of their relationship and kind of helps them in a bunch of ways, emotionally in the film, I guess. Elio's mom is actually very supportive of Elio and Oliver's relationship, and her ownership and her maintenance of the garden and the trees and the orchard and all the fruits and the knowledge that she has of it is not an accident. She's this gatekeeper almost of support and sustenance, but also with this really tangible and deep connection to the characters in that she's Elio's mother and has a lot of love for him. So fruit is used in this film a lot. It's used in full fruit form as something that people eat. It's also drunk. The juice is drunk a lot and represents a lot of insatiability, a lot of sweetness, a lot of lack of control, specifically in Oliver.
All right, pecan juice?
Yeah.
Here, to that.
Thank you. Certainly, chérie. Merci.
Help yourself to some water.
And as a really physical and tangible manifestation of sexual desire and non-normative sexual expression. So one of the most famous scenes in this film is one where Elio masturbates with a peach. I'm not going to play that scene, mainly because it's just not very interesting to listen to, but I am going to play the song that Elio listens to in the scene. It's called Radio Varsavia, Warsaw Radio in Italian. Thanks so much for tuning in to A Love Letter to Call Me By Your Name for Pride programming on CITR 101.9 FM.
With the upcoming municipal election, housing in the Lower Mainland remains a vital issue. This Wednesday, July 25th, a panel of activists, politicians, developers, and experts on the front line of housing strategies will gather for a forum on housing for the Port Coquitlam area. But the event will be incomplete without you. Meet at the Michael Wright Art Gallery in Port Coquitlam, July 25th, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. to make your voice heard on housing. July 29th to August 5th is Pride Week in Vancouver. Check out events across the city, walk in the Trans March, Dyke March, and Pride Parades, and remember to stay hydrated. From all of us queers and allies at CITR Discorder, to all of our LGBTQIA2S+ listeners, happy Pride.
Scendevano in pigiama per le scale per aiutare i prigionieri. Facevano le bende con lenzuola. E i cittadini attoniti fingevano di non capire niente per aiutare i disertori. E chi scappava in Occidente Radio Varsavia. L'ultimo appello è da dimenticare. E
savia, l'ultimo appello è da dimenticare. E i commercianti punici prendevano sentieri di montagna per evitare i doganieri ed arrivare in Abissinia. La Cina era lontana, l'orgoglio di fantastiche operaie che lavoravano la seta, le biciclette di Shanghai. Radio Varsavia, l'ultimo appello è da dimenticare. Radio Varsavia, l'ultimo appello è da dimenticare.
Into cold, it's so scary when my heart is tangible, but I like it when you're here and see me glow. Sit back and watch me glow. Oh. And live in the hope of soon. Sit back and let me bloom.
I'm not sure what I want, but I know that I want it all. I know I speak in traps, but you should learn just not to fall deeper. Heart and people get lost into me. My heart's overflowing. I'm young and exploding.
Fools on fire.
FM Vancouver Reloaded, playing your favorite tunes and mouth-humping your ear holes full of voice talk. Yeah, we do that.
Welcome back to A Love Letter to Call Me By Your Name, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM from the unceded ancestral and traditional land of the Hencominum-speaking Musqueam people on UBC Vancouver campus. You just heard Radio Varsavia, a song off of the soundtrack for Call Me By Your Name, Luca Guadagnino's 2017 film, and then also the song Endless Summer by Montreal artist November. I thought that this song was fitting for a few reasons. One, that November is a queer artist. Also, Call Me By Your Name is set in the summer and feels absolutely endless. But then also the lyrics have a lot of references to King Midas, an ancient Greek king, and the tradition of turning something to gold by touching it, which is kind of Midas's gift and curse, but also the idea that summer and this kind of like golden idyllic age are connected in some way, and also just talking about love. So it felt quite perfect actually to play, but that's what I want to talk about now, this classicism that runs throughout the film and how it's used. So the most kind of poignant scene that I can think of is when they do eventually go dredging with Elia's father, and they find this gorgeous statue of a young boxer. And Elio and Oliver kind of connect over it, and then later these statues come up again.
Negua.
Hey, boys!
The ship went down in 1827 on the way to Isola de Garda. Gossip has it this statue was a gift from Count Leiki to his lover, Contralto Adelaida Malanotte. There are four known sets after the Praxiteles originals. This fellow's at number three. The Emperor Hadrian had a pair dug up at Tivoli, but one of the more philistine of the Farnese popes melted them down and had them recast as a particularly voluptuous Venus.
Before we head back.
Several hundred color slides of our boxer and the others like him arrived yesterday from Berlin. Huh. We should start cataloging them. I'll keep us busy till lunch, I imagine.
Sure. Oh, beautiful, aren't they?
Mm. But they're all so incredibly sensual.
Because these are more Hellenistic than 5th century Athenian. Most likely sculpted under the influence of Praxiteles. Greatest sculptor in antiquity. Muscles are firm. Look at his stomach, for example. Not a straight body in these statues. They're all curved. Sometimes impossibly curved. And so nonchalant. Hence their ageless ambiguity. As if they're daring you to desire them.
So this sequence really perfectly, I think, encapsulates how classics and antiquity are incorporated into the film and the narrative to make a case for normalizing homosexuality and enticing that kind of desire between the two men. So that clip kind of starts with them at the ocean, and Elio's father's colleague has dragged up this gorgeous statue, and he's telling the history of it and the sexualization of it and the periods of latency that the statue has gone through as being submerged in the ocean, but then also its narrative and its kind of sibling statues' narratives as it's been transformed over time. And then it transitions into Oliver and Professor Perlman going through different pictures and slides of the statue and statues like it, and talking about their kind of space in antiquity. And these two sequences not only encapsulate the theme of antiquity, but then also the role of water as well, which is kind of the last thing that I really want to talk about. So antiquity as a space for transformation, as a space for beauty, and kind of like as history allowing new narratives to be made within that, is really, really cool. And just like also kind of making everything kind of fantastical and beautiful. But then water plays a really amazing role in this film as a natural element where people can connect physically usually, and an opportunity to kind of release yourself as you're floating in water. You're not kind of tethered to the physical world as much. And again, it allows you to have this fantastical experience that being in the normal world doesn't allow you. And it adds this kind of glow to not only the relationship between Oliver and Elio, and this fantastical, again, sacredness and purity to it, but it makes it impermeable. It's an impermeable gay bubble where there's no mention of the AIDS crisis, which was a huge issue in America at that time. There's no character who is homophobic, not understanding, not supportive, and how the film uses water to achieve this is really impressive. We have now reached almost the end of our hour. I just want to touch on some of the things that the film does that are pretty harmful, kind of building off what I was just saying. It completely removes the characters from any of the real challenges or experiences that gay people were facing in 1983, in Italy in 1983, in America in 1983. And I do really appreciate that element to it. You kind of stop being scared and you just fall into it and enjoy what's being shared between the two characters. But it doesn't acknowledge or appreciate that history. But I don't think that it was meant to. I think this film is a fantasy, and that is what Guadagnino was trying to achieve. And in that case, he really did marvelously. The big thing, though, that this film was criticized for, and this narrative itself was criticized for, was the age difference between the two characters. So I mentioned at the beginning of this episode that Elio is 17 years old and Oliver is 24 years old. That is a significant gap. It's 7 years, and it's the kind of gap that may be acceptable if they were a little older, but Elio is still a minor. It's hard to accept this film without, again, kind of isolating it. If you approach this film with the attitude of, this is not reality, this is complete fantasy, you're able to enjoy it, and the really blatant tenderness and expertly shot and communicated sensuality of the film is impeccable and very easy to be lost in. But if you contextualize it in any way, it's a hard story to swallow, especially with Oliver being a grad student working for Elio's father. There's a bizarre power dynamic there. The age is very bizarre, and the sexual experience differential is also really worrying. So Oliver has had sexual experiences with men before meeting Elio, and Oliver is Elio's first active male sexual partner. There's a scene where Oliver expresses concern over Elio's ability to make these decisions, but it's just, again, kind of touched upon and then disregarded.
Oliver!
Oliver!
You're not sick of me yet?
No, I just wanted to be with you. I'll go.
Do you know how happy I am that we slept together?
I don't know.
Of course you don't know. I don't want you to regret anything. And I hate the thought that maybe I may have messed you up. I don't want either of us to pay for this.
No, it's not like I'm gonna tell anyone. You're not gonna be like in any trouble.
That's not what I'm talking about.
The worrying thing about that, especially in the context of this film, is that it's a historical trend in politics and cultural narratives that homosexuality is akin to pedophilia and predatory behavior. And I feel like it's obvious that that's not what this movie's trying to do, but it's really concerning that it's not touched on or even addressed beyond really that quick scene. And this is the most popular reason that I've heard cited into why people didn't enjoy the film, and completely fair. I'm privileged enough that I was really able to look beyond it, but it is a really disconcerting element of the film. The other thing that I really wanted to talk about was the classism in this film. Judging by the other films that I've seen of Guadagninos, he's not especially concerned with people of lower socioeconomic status. Both I Am Love and Call Me By Your Name, which are really similar in a lot of ways, but they're both set in these huge Italian mansions. I think Guadagnino has an attraction to precisely the isolation or the removal of mansions that, like, finances allow you. And if you're going to be removed and completely isolated, why not make it completely stunning? But the characters are so wealthy that it, again, makes it hard to see them as anything beyond this fantasy. And I'm trying to accept the fantasy and I'm trying to embrace it and believe it, but it's quite difficult. And I'm sure that other viewers have experienced this as well. But it also makes the film a little disappointing, because when you accept the fantasy in this way, or if you do kind of give into it, it acknowledges almost that the really pure tenderness that is depicted in the film is not a tangible or relatable thing. The idea that this film is a part of a desire trilogy, a trilogy all about, like, what it means to be desired, to desired, and the consequences of it, is really illuminating, I think. The desire and, like, fulfillment of that is really gratifying. The loss of it is really devastating, which is depicted in the film as well. But the surrealism of it, the, like, dreaminess of it is also communicated as well. But no, love is perfect. Every relationship has its rough spots, and everyone has to put some effort and work in to make things work, and I'm willing to do that for this movie. Despite its bizarre shortcomings and problematic ideology in a lot of ways, it's still the most endearing and sensitive and tender and inviting films that I've seen in a really long time. And it's not something that I'm gonna stop enjoying anytime soon. Thank you so much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM today for Pride programming and for joining me on this open love letter journey to Luca Guadagnino's 2017 film, Call Me By Your Name. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you fell a little bit in love with this movie, and I hope you go home and watch it. Dear Call Me By Your Name, I love you. Sincerely, Dora.
Were you directly affected by the LGBT purge in the Canadian Armed Forces, RCMP, or Federal Public Service? If so, a legal settlement may affect your rights. You may be eligible to receive compensation of $5,000 to $50,000 or more in cases of exceptional harm, as well as other non-financial benefits, or you may choose to opt out of the settlement. Information about the settlement, deadlines, your rights, and the claims process is available at LGBTPurgeSettlement.com. That's LGBTPurgeSettlement.com. July 29th to August 5th is Pride Week in Vancouver. Check out events across the city, walk in the Trans March, Dyke March, and Pride Parades, and remember to stay hydrated. From all of us queers and allies at CITR Discorder, to all of our LGBTQIA2S+ listeners, happy Pride.